James Anderson from SD Bullion. Welcome to The Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Tom. It's always good to be back.
Absolutely. You know, it's kind of funny. You and I were reminiscing a little bit before we hit record here this morning of how long we've been speaking for, some of the doldrums of the market, you know, over the past 6 years. And then now things are getting exciting. And it's interesting to think about the road that we've traveled in some ways together in that time. I remember, I think it was the first time I spoke to you, your cat fell out the window and stuff like that.
Yep.
So James, why don't we start with what are some of the explanations for all of the volatility right now in the silver market?
So the volatility is explainable because, you know, it kind of goes back and forth where you have a situation where physical premiums, especially in silver on the eastern side of the world, have been driving price higher and higher and higher. And then as well, levered derivatives can move that market depending on the way they're trading in sharp directions. So what you saw was a big sell-off that happened, obviously, at the end of last week, where a whole bunch of people FOMO'd into this trade, and you had a huge amount of options betting going on in the SLV market. And such like that. So, you know, to see a waterfall decline like that in a bull market, it just shows you that basically a couple things is that the price that we're being shown day to day is a confluence of physical and derivatives. It's not simply physical. It's not simply derivatives. It's a combination of the two. And there's always a give and take, a pull tug that's happening. And so in the end, ultimately, I think the physical market wins this battle. But it doesn't mean that derivatives don't play huge volatility to the down and upside along the way. And that's what I think what we saw. I mean, the fact that you have the world silver market re-rate the price of silver by negative one-third intraday, just all of a sudden clear out of blue sky for no fundamental reasons, really, that just shows you how sick and disturbed and how weird this price discovery market has been for a long time and is still. So we're going to talk about, you know, obviously the long-term ideas of why this is and where it's going to probably go. But in the meantime, this is why generally, if you're interested in this market, you definitely want to keep a lot physically outside the system because it takes away a lot of, it gives you peace of mind. It takes away a lot of all the worrying about trading on the short term. You can just kind of keep your stack to the side and wait for, you know, valuations that are both fair value and or overvalued to start paring down the trade. In the short term, if you're going to swing trade stuff, you know, keep it limited, keep it single digits, because most people who are doing that are not pros, and you're not sitting in London with inside information that those folks have, and so you're going to be at the you're going to be on the wrong side a lot of times because these traders have more firepower, more optics, more ability to move markets whichever way they see. So, it's just something to keep in mind that this is going to be a wild ride, but the long term is still intact completely.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's so many pieces that I think we need to kind of pull apart here. So why don't we start with the idea that coming into month end, and especially OPEX or options expiry, how does that create a lot of volatility, and why do those moments in time, or moments especially at the end of months, create so much volatility, both on the up and downside?
So I do not trade options generally, although I may end up doing it because, you know, there's a lot of opportunity and potential to make money in that. But you have to know that if you're doing call options, essentially you're putting down a bet that if it doesn't play out, it just ups and vanishes. So your downside is what the bet is, you know, the fact that it could literally go to zero. And then the upside, this could be very nice. But again, this is micro bets. This is like, you know, walking by the craps table and sticking down, you know, a couple of things on a few different, you know, numbers that you feel are, you know, that you've done the research on that you think are potentially hittable. Mm-hmm. Generally, if you're going to play in that market too, also, you would probably want to bet long, like in terms of like a duration time frame, you need to think in terms of 1 year or more. So you have time for your hunches to play out, not so much short term, which is what a lot of these people were doing. You had a lot of Reddit type squeezers, memers who were running in retail wise that were doing all types of wild bets on the SLV side. And generally what you end up seeing is that, you know, by the time, there will be a max pain level that the market will always seem to find no matter what happens. And generally, it will pull back to a point where those that are creating the options, those that are making the market in the options, will scathe out with the most profit possible with the least amount of loss possible. And so generally, they have the market by the shorts and curlies, and anybody who thinks otherwise generally ends up, you know, losing their options bets. So I think the call wall was around 100 SLV at the time. And that's generally, you know, we went below it. So anybody on the short side of that bet at the end of those short-term bets probably did best. And so, you know, what you see is a lot of, I saw it on Twitter. There's just been a lot of, you know, market like this, it attracts a lot of short, arrogant type, you know, callers who basically come in and say, oh yeah, this is an easy trade. I'm going to come in and, you know, short and puts on SLV, you know, below 100, and they'll make some profit, and then they'll sit there and turn around and mock, you know, silver longs, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, that's like a short-term trade. I don't really get too involved in that type of stuff. Like I said, it's kind of a single-digit arena that I play in. I have more of a long view. So just know if you're going to play in that market, you're probably not an insider, and therefore not being an insider, you're going to get taken a whole bunch. So you have to keep that in mind. Mm-hmm.
James, should we be separating how we're thinking about the volatility within the gold versus the silver market? Like, are there different players? Are there different forces? Are there any different explanations for the volatility in gold versus silver?
I think you have to keep in mind that there's a lot of leverage as well in Asia, right? In China, on the Shanghai Futures Exchange, there's just been a huge amount of volume of late. It attracts a lot of gambling types in China who are not necessarily interested in getting 15 kilo bar loadouts and paying 13% VAT and stacking massive amounts of bars. They're much more interested in scalps, right? And generally, a newbie in a market like this only understands the long side. They really don't understand the short side, much less the short side in a bull market. That's a very specific type set that kind of understands how to play that game. And so what you see is not simply just on the Western side of the world, but you also see it in the Eastern side of the world, where there's just a lot of levered players in both sides, especially in silver, because of just the amount of upside volatility that's been attracting that type of person. So to have that wash out, to break some of those people, to leave them in ditches is fine. That's what you kind of want. You don't want that type of player in your market because it skews the prices up and down a little too much. What you'd rather is just a steady incline, a steady rise with as few shakeouts like that as possible. But look, ultimately, there's going to be bigger shakeouts than that down the line. So you need to be prepared for that psychologically. I mean, that 33% drawdown, when will we get another one of those? I would imagine at some point down the line, we will see that again in this bull market. And it probably won't even be the top when that occurs again. Mm-hmm.
So how do we, like, stepping back a little bit, James, do you think that we are in a new era for silver price rebalancing? Like, we've seen it 5 or 6 times over the last 40 years. But what do you think also makes this different than the other times we've seen that?
So, yeah, I have data from Nick Large's Gold Charts R Us that basically shows from 1970 until now, you know, the price of silver, not simply within COMEX hours, but also outside of COMEX hours and being aggregated, meaning that, you know, it's a snapshot daily that gets added up over time. And what you end up seeing is that intra COMEX hours, the price of silver over the last 55 years plus has generally gone down. But there are times where you get into a bull market where that equilibrium price where we started at 1970, which was $1.92 and a half. Yeah, it was $1.92.5 an ounce. So almost $2 an ounce is where it started. And that's more or less the Mendoza line. And there have been 4 iterations of time in the last 55 years where the $2 Mendoza line has been hit. And generally that was the sign that you're reaching either interim top in a structural bull market with the cyclical bear coming up, or you're hitting the top of that secular bull market. So it happened in like 74, 75-ish, somewhere in there. 73. It happened as well in 1980, obviously. It happened in 2006, 7, 8, multiple times. It kept hitting it, and they both rode up together. It happened in 2011, which is the only time where they reconverged these price sets, where they reconverged and then quickly they basically split away again. And that's where we are today from that split. So this is the fifth time. And basically what it's showing you is that the world has to rebalance. You have disequilibrium or just kind of incoherence in the price discovery on one side of the world versus the other. Mm-hmm. And ultimately there comes times where they get in unison and they go together. And so this will be the fifth time. And it calls for much, much higher prices at the moment. The two data sets, the one data set outside COMEX has ballooned up over the last, there was a period of time between like 2019 to like 2024 where it ballooned up to like $400 an ounce. And it's basically hovered in that range from 400 to 380 bucks. And it's been that way for about a year and a half, just kind of hovering there. Whereas the COMEX intraday price has been going up a wall, essentially. I mean, we had this conversation, say, a year ago. Silver was 32 spot. Gold was, 2,800 spot. And so where we are a year later is probably something that people are taking for granted, that they're not considering how far we've already come. But the fact is that this is happening. And generally, when this is occurring, it never goes back. It doesn't. Once the worm has turned and silver starts running up a price wall like this, yes, there'll be volatility, but generally you are in a secular bull market that will not stop until we have a reconvergence of these price data sets.
Mm-hmm. How do we go about trying to increase metals market literacy? And what do you think the biggest misconceptions are for both, let's say, veterans and newbies alike?
So it's difficult because you have, mainly the social media channels where people are getting their information who are new to this market are YouTube and Twitter X. And you have a confluence of different parties there who are using truth and then mixing lies in order to get a lot of hysterics and basically interest, because everybody's always looking for some cutting edge information that's going to like swing the market and they'll be first to find it. And so there's this constant search for literal ore in the information funnel, and most of it's fool's gold. Very, very much of what you see in the hype channels is like a decent amount of truth mixed with a lot of bullshit. And so what you end up finding is that probably 80 to 90% of the stuff that you see day to day is garbage. It's not worth like taking to consideration. It's not worth even investigating. Once you've done enough research and understand the market, you basically just scroll right past those things. You can just see them right off the top. Like, that is a waste of time. There's no way that's true. Move on, And so for someone who's new here, it's difficult because it's going to take you some time to understand, how this market works, because it's much more complex than, say, gold. Silver is much more complex in the sense that it has, industrial demand and investment demand, store value demand, a confluence of the two. And they're also always kind of tug of warring as well. And in between that, you got a whole bunch of AI bots pumping videos out, who knows from where. I'm guessing, Pakistan, who knows? It's probably a play, I would assume, like the Asian AI channels, probably a play for views and for literal, clicks and cash from views. I think that's mainly what that is, because they understand that people who are interested in the silver market have a voracious appetite for it and will watch virtually anything that's printed. And so they print videos over and over every day. And again, about 80% of it might be true. About 20% is generally unfunded nonsense that sounds salacious and exciting, and it makes people feel great. But ultimately, I think it's a play to get view counts and to make cash in terms of views. On the other side, you have Twitter farm channels that basically most of the people are anonymous. They just have like an avatar, so who the hell knows who they are? And they just say things that are just salacious and ridiculous. And it's just generally to get engagement on Twitter and to get kickbacks in Twitter engagement fees as well. So, it's difficult. It's how to do it is you got to spend some time doing proper due diligence and learning about this market yourself, not having some guru tell you it. You need to actually do the work yourself. That's generally how you learn best, is by firsthand operating and doing it, as opposed to being told by anyone. Because generally, if that's the case, you're going to get in a place where what you've been told is probably not true. So you need to actually do the research and understand how to find, the truth in the market. And that's not easy. It's a lot easier said than done, yep. But it requires real work, real research, real time consuming work though. I mean, nowadays with AI though, you can do a decent amount of research that's good. I wouldn't even trust AI though. You still have to go to the sources and you got to do further research to confirm a lot of things that you're being told.
Well, because it's just pulling from the information that's being built. You're getting right. This AI slop feedback loop.
Mm-hmm.
And, one of the other things we were talking about before we hit record is like the idea that any of these Bored Ape avatars, let's say 90% of the Bored Ape avatars, or any of those cartoon character type avatars, you can pretty much completely discount anything that accounts like that have been saying. But it's interesting to think about that this isn't really, this isn't the first time that the silver market has been subject to disinformation or misinformation, whatever term we want to use for it. I remember in the last silver squeeze, just after COVID, there was a ton of this type of pumping and very misleading information that was being put out, and it makes me wonder why silver especially is so apt to have that type of mischaracterization of information within it.
Yeah, the reason being is kind of why we like gold and silver, because it's of its opacity. The fact that you can actually have the stuff privately outside the system, and it's very difficult to track in or trace. So it gives you optionality that totally is, that gets outside of the typical system where people are just clicking buttons, buying and trading, and on all types of leverage. And who the hell knows, whether or not, you won't be great taken down the line. Ultimately, that opacity allows for a pack of wild people to come in and just make up any type of salacious rumor. And the other problem is, I don't know, so you could say a high 90 percentile of citizens in the United States have virtually no financial education at all. They are literally set up to be taken. And so the question is, like, can these people handle this? Not most of them. Most of them can barely handle balancing a checkbook. They don't even understand basic, finance 101. And so for them to come walking in here, literally walking into buzz saws, because there's a lot of people out here who will take advantage of them. And that's precisely what you see. It's disheartening. It sucks. But at the very minimum, at least we could do that, just flat out tell them the truth. You are the target. You are the mark. So you better figure that out quick and understand how not to be a victim.
So James, going back to the, let's say, the fundamentals within this market at this point, are the supply deficits that we've been talking about for years really finally coming home to roost? And does this supply shortfall create the conditions for industrials like Samsung to go directly to silver producers to try and secure metal for their processes?
Yeah, on the positive side, you're dead on. We have a 1,000 ounce bar tightness and shortage rolling. That's kind of happening in the Western world. And then on the Eastern world, we have 15 kilo bar inventory levels in the Shanghai Gold Exchange, the Shanghai Futures Exchange, at levels that have not been hit, low levels have not been seen since 2016. There's 30, last I looked, 30.8 million ounces of 15 kilo silver bars sitting in the combined Shanghai Gold Exchange and Shanghai Futures Exchange. And that is in a world, or in a country, that's basically the largest manufacturer in the world. They literally, half the auto sales within that country are EVs, which require loadings of estimated 1 ounce and two-thirds, 1 2/3 an ounce of silver in each car, right? So industry players in the Chinese side surely have seen this coming, and they front ran this. And that's why you see the inventory drawdowns that have already occurred, because they saw this coming ahead of time. They probably pulled a lot of that metal and stockpiling it in their own warehouses and on their balance sheets. What you end up seeing now is those industry players that are late didn't understand of the situation, and they're probably coming in late, and they're bidding up the prices, and that's why you're seeing premiums so high. As well, you're seeing investors come in and do the same on the eastern side. In the western side of the world, you have the COMEX registered pile, which was at 200 million ounces in September of 2025, before India came, barreling in, demanding massive amounts for their over 10 ETFs that are constantly getting inflows for silver. And so you saw massive chunks that happened, massive amounts of silver inflows in those ETFs twice in the last year. The number of registered ounces in September 2025 was at 200 million, or just over. It's whittled down to like 104 million ounces. So it's essentially halved in 5 months, right? I mean, that should set off alarm bells. The fact that all that, all that Trump metal that came in for the tariffs, and everybody whooping and hollering, and now, the COMEX is like the leader of all this metal. See you later. Like, half of that stuff's already gone. So, you know, all that nationalism was just didn't understand the fact that, you know, we didn't set up parameters to not see that metal offshore when the time came. And obviously the time came when India came into the market in London, and London lease rates jacked up to levels that we had not seen perhaps in history, or the last time perhaps when Buffett came and raided the silver market in the 90s, in 97, roughly. So you have a tightness too in London. What you end up seeing right now is, I think the latest crash in terms of price going from, you know, 121 down to, what was it, 75 intraday, what you end up probably seeing, and it's already happening, is that the unsecured ETFs in London are probably being rated by the APs of, say, SLB. They'll borrow shares. They'll convert the 50,000 share baskets into 1,000 ounce bars, which retail cannot do. Retail, if you own SLB, you own nothing but price risk, upside, downside. But the APs themselves can play, you know, games behind the scenes in order to pull 1,000 ounce bars in order to take advantage of arbitrages and premiums over in the East. So essentially, you draw the price down, you pull those 1,000 ounce bars at very cheap levels versus where they were the day before, and then you turn around as the price rises up like it is today or whatever in the future, you can move that those 1,000 ounce bars, not only with the price difference, taking that gap for profit, but also whatever premiums are over there. So you're talking a potential of moving, you know, millions of ounces, basically making $15, $20 or more per ounce. I mean, that is a gigantic arbitrage. That's bank desk bonuses. That's a lot of currency to make if you are a market maker in London, which is essentially what I'm guessing is going on. I mean, it's not even a guess. You could see the action in SLB, the amount of tonnage that was pulled when India came in last year. There was two different instances in time where SLB had gigantic outflows of like 16 million and roughly 30 million toward the end of last year, ounces that were being pulled. So my guess is this next pull factor will be on par with the end of December 2025, which is probably 30 million or more chunk will come out of SLB. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, SLB is a slush fund. It is basically a fund that the banks use in order to make profits for themselves, insider profits, because they know how to move the markets with derivatives. And ultimately, they're the only ones that can pull the 1,000-ounce bars, and they use the customer funds to pull this off. And in the meantime, you get price, you know, risk, whether it be to the up or downside, and that's what you get to hold. And if the whole thing falls apart, you get nothing, and they get whatever. You know, JP Morgan is the custodian, so essentially they get whatever's inside there, and they can keep it. So that's the game that's being played in the sense of, like, you know, people are gambling these markets on the short term, but I don't think they understand the long-term ramifications if this thing falls apart or if it goes really wrong.
You know, as many times as we've discussed this, James, it always surprises me that there are people that don't understand that they don't actually own a claim to metal if they're buying an ETF like that. Mm-hmm. Are there any other, you know, like PSLV was pointed to in the last silver squeeze as being a far better product, but do you have any indication that is a far superior product, or are there other, you know, ETFs that give you some more peace of mind than SLV, let's say?
In the Western world, there's not many, right? PSLV is a close-end fund, so it's a little bit different than most of the other ETFs. It has been trading below net asset value, meaning if you buy into shares, you're theoretically getting more silver per your cash. So for instance, if you look around right now and bullion premiums are a little too high for your taste, you could park theoretically some cash in PSLV, get price exposure, and then when the premiums on the physical side get back into line that's more to your taste, then you could obviously sell the PSLV and buy the bullion yourself. Again, you're in the system between here to there, so you know that is the risk you run. PSLV does have some drawdowns. I think I did see a recent drawdown of like over 1 million ounces. So you know theoretically, people can you know redeem shares for 1,000-ounce bars. You don't have to be like an AP in the sense of SLV. So that does give some optionality to people who are large and who do want to get 1,000-ounce bar pulls and simplify it by not having to go through all the COMEX rigmarole and going through brokers to do that. So it gives you some optionality there. In terms of, like, you know, in the end, like, if you're playing in 1,000-ounce bars, you're probably a pretty sophisticated investor. You're probably a pretty large investor. My suggestion would be that if you do that, then just make sure that you put them in non-bank storage in places like Brinks or Loomis with your direct account. Do not use some middleman account. Do not have some other entity in between you and the metal. It should be you being able to call up Brinks and or Loomis and telling them what to do with said 1,000-ounce bars, as opposed to having some middleman between you and your metals. So generally the system is set up, you know, in the way that you have to go through a middleman to get your metals. And when you have that kind of size, you don't have to do that. You can just, you know, you can go directly and negotiate, and I would suggest you negotiate at management fees that are, you know, basically SLV's management fees, which is 50 basis points per year. You should be able to get that type of account with any of those large entities in the same price range, roughly 0.5% per year, to have them stored and have it physically insured, et cetera. So anyways, on the ETF side, the other point is, I do think that, like, I don't think that India plays as many games as we do in the Western world. I think their ETFs are generally set up in like a fair and honest way. Eventually they'll probably too fall to corruption, but for now they're not as corrupt as Western ETFs. So my suggestion is, you know, each one is different. Each one has different mechanics. Each one requires thorough studying. And if you're literally going to have a lot of capital parked in any of them, you have to do a lot of work, which means you have to go through the prospectuses, need to read how they operate. You need to understand, well, let me think in terms of how they're screwing me over, because eventually, I mean, you are the customer. You are the one that has to pay into this thing. And so you better make sure whatever you're paying into, you're getting back in terms of, you know, there being value for you.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned India, because I wanted to ask you, what do you think the difference is, let's say, between the West versus the East mentality is in metal? And, you know, is it the same, like, is their demand significantly higher right now over, let's say, the last year than it has been in the last five, because of this, you know, given good type nature of the metals, where the more the price rises, the more people think that they need to FOMO in and that they're missing out on value.
Mm-hmm. So India is an interesting case because they have millennia of their currencies coming and going. So that's generally why multi-generations generally have gold and silver as part of their, you know, long-term holdings. And they always keep gold and silver as their long-haul holdings because they've gone through so many cycles of currencies coming on. And so it's kind of ingrained in their DNA. So what's been happening a lot is you have gold kind of going to unaffordium levels a lot. So I'm guessing a lot of thrifting into silver is occurring on like the farm level, on the brick and mortar level in that country. You're probably going to start to see a lot more silver jewelry, high-grade silver jewelry buying, maybe clad in gold. I don't know. But generally, you're going to end up seeing people not being able to afford gold because you just don't get much back for your currency, and thrifting into silver, be it in jewelry or in investment cases. As well, you know, people understand, I think, if gold has done multiples since, say, 2020 or 2011 high, and silver has yet to do that many multiples, well, it begs the reason that in a bull market, silver eventually catches up to what gold has done and outperforms what gold has done. And so you kind of look to swing trade off of gold's performance with silver, using silver as the, you know, the ability to get a little bit more in terms of returns. The thing is, obviously, that silver is more volatile, so you have to kind of set your trade up to be able to handle that and stomach all the volatility along the way. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you also have the industrial side of silver in the in India as well as in China. India obviously is trying to industrialize. They're trying to build out battery parks. They're trying to build out, you know, various things in terms of EV cars, et cetera, solar panel building. They've talked about the fact that their refining capacity is just not good enough. They basically need to start doing refining for silver in terms of, you know, mines that do zinc mining or copper mining. Generally, most of those flows go through China, and India knows that they're kind of getting, you know, they're in an inferior or in a weak position because they don't have that ability, because they don't have enough infrastructure, and they need to start spending more currency in, you know, inside their country and capital in order to build out that refining capacity. So they're not just simply having to go beg from the West or beg from China with premiums to be able to get those 1,000-ounce bars that they need for their investment and industrial players. So this is a long road. This is something that India is going to get wealthier as time goes along. So will China. And they are the gorillas when it comes to gold and silver markets. So as long as those young people are still enthused and excited about gold and silver on the investment side, you damn well bet it'll keep building. The FOMO will still get crazier and crazier. And then the industrial side, you know, silver is very difficult to replace or thrift. So if you want your products to work, you actually have to spend the money and put it in there. So generally, that's the combination of the two should help on the long haul. Mm-hmm.
How are the short positions that have been held by the bullion banks for years, how do those fit into this price action too right now?
So the short positions that banks have theoretically been holding for years is difficult to know because, you know, there's so many opaque markets. And then there's also markets where you kind of get a clue, at least of what they've been doing. So like on the COMEX, you'll see different reports about different banks working within their house or their client accounts. And that gives you some view, but that's just the partial view of what's happening. You don't really know what's happening on the London side and opaque derivatives over there. And so you don't really necessarily know. And a lot of people will make declarations on Twitter or on YouTube that, you know, banks are short and some banks are going to fail and this and that. And the bottom line is nobody knows. Nobody knows unless you're at that bank desk, truthfully, about whether or not they're lopsided. I would think that they will play pivots in both directions, you know, knowing whichever way the market's probably going to trend in the short and medium term, be it long, net long, or they will go net short, or they will simply do big arbitrage plays like the silver ETF 1,000 ounce loadouts that we had. That's not even all that risky. Basically, you push the price down, you get the 1,000 ounce bars out of there, you let the price, you know, start moving back up, and then you turn around and sell all that stuff to India. There's not a huge amount of risk in that trade. So you're in a situation where, you know, you don't know specifically what the banks are doing, but your best optics are going to be, you know, monitoring the inventory levels. You need to monitor, obviously, day-to-day price action, how things are moving. You need to monitor import-export data. You need to monitor, you know, what is going on in the macro space, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not as simple as like, oh, you know, the COMEX report says this bank is short this, so therefore they're net short. Like, that's just a wild, wild conclusion to come to. That's probably like you're literally taking like a micro snapshot for 1 second and expounding it and saying that that's the way it is. It's nuts. It doesn't make a damn lick of sense.
Mm-hmm. Are bullion dealers having a hard time operating in this environment where prices are so volatile, moving so fast, and, you know, we have to consider that they operate within not a leveraged framework, but a financed framework where they're trying to buy metal. They are having a hard time getting metal, and they're having a hard time, let's say, hedging that metal for that time period risk that they have to hold it.
Yeah. Virtually every layer in the entire precious metals industry, I don't care what you're talking about, is under massive pressure and multifolds of demand. And in terms of everything, like phone calls coming at you, people wanting to sell to you, people wanting to buy to you. Basically, every layer has been inundated and overwhelmed. The industry is only so large to handle so much capacity because that's generally the way the industry maintains profitability. If it had too many staff, it would end up going bankrupt. So you need to have just enough staff to be able to handle in a profitable way the business. But obviously, business is multifolded in terms of interest and people who are getting into it. And what you see is every layer virtually getting overwhelmed. Like at the end of last week, at SD Bullion, the Friday was like 4x in terms of the amount of buying that day that happened in terms of the normal day-to-day buying. And then in terms of the month, it was the largest month in terms of notional sales ever. It blew away even the 2023, you know, Silicon Valley rolling bank failures that were occurring. You know, if anybody can remember back to 2023, where there was like three or four banks that basically failed and went under. And there was a lot of people very worried about whether or not that was going to set off some chain reaction in the bank system. So you had a huge influx of people buying silver and gold in March 2023. We've passed that now. And it's simply because you have a combination of, you know, price obviously performing, people seeing and FOMOing in, and then price dipping extremely strongly on Friday and people saying, well, that's a pretty good price compared to where we've been. I think the fundamentals are still sound. I'm going to buy into it. And they came in massive waves. So, yeah, it's a good question. It also it affects brick and mortar dealers in the United States. I'm sure you're hearing a lot of stories about, oh, we have too much inventory. Well, guess what, Jack? Now you don't have any inventory. Now, what are you going to do? Right? Now you're going to turn around and buy from your customers at a reasonable price, I bet, because you don't have any inventory. That's how you make a business. Right? So now it's time to jack up the bid price finally. So, yeah, I mean, it goes both ways, right? These things change very quickly. People get into these narratives of like, oh, this is the way the market is and it'll be that way forever. So screw this market. No, the market goes, you know, it swings wildly from one way to another. And in a matter of just a day or two, it can happen. And that's basically what we saw in the last weekend of this.
Well, you know, like, let's say over the last, I don't want to say necessarily the last 5 years, but let's say before 2020, the market was, you know, there were crickets in the market.
No, totally.
So you,
totally.
to your point about having only so much staff, the entire industry has so much capacity. And then when you dump a huge amount of demand into it, it takes time for physical businesses to be able to ramp up, to start refining, to start having, you know, not only balance financing desks,
balance sheets that can handle it.
Balance sheets, staff, shipping, you know, there's so many logistical considerations that most people just like aren't considering. And that's, I think, a big thing that's kind of missing from the discussion as well. What are you seeing, you know, like, I think it was over a month ago already that refiners stopped taking metal within the US. Why is that? Why do they not, A, want to be taking metal, and B, like, why don't they have the capacity to be taking, you know, as one guest put it, the underwear drawer silver that is wanting to be sold at these higher levels?
Yeah, so you're referring mainly to 90% silver. We have a lot of that left over in the United States, the pre-1965 coinage that a lot of people have been holding on to and just sitting in their house. And sometimes when, you know, the opportunity strikes and you're near triple-digit silver, a lot of people came and sold from 50 to 120, say. There was a lot of dumping of that metal on their local coin dealer networks. And, you know, a couple things people need to remember: local coin dealer networks is where a lot of people sell. Online is where a lot of people buy. So you have kind of two highways happening. Of course, local coin dealer, you can go and buy, and people do that in cash a lot of times to keep it extremely private. But they definitely do that when they go to sell because they like to keep that private, right? When you're dealing with an online dealer, you know, obviously there are some records between bank wire transfers or ACH, you know, or payments, et cetera. So there are digital records that those transactions occur. So that on the buy side, people don't really fear too much doing that. But on the sell side, some people, if they're playing under, you know, I don't know what they're thinking, would they want to keep their transactions private? A lot of times they'll sell to local coin dealers. So the question about the refiners, 90%, and the dealers, the local coin dealers, they just don't have deep enough pockets to handle it, like flat out. Like they have only so much capital to handle day-to-day operations. And when they get inundated with you know, people coming to sell to them, what ends up happening is they basically start lowering their bids. And they'll just keep balking and lowering their bids further and further until people either turn away or accept it and then go yell online about how terrible the bid price was. Yeah. And so, you know, just because someone gives you a bid price and doesn't mean you need to take it. I wouldn't dare go to a coin shop unless I called ahead. I wouldn't waste my time getting in a car unless I called ahead and had an idea of what the hell we just agreed to on the phone for what I'm going to offer you. So these are the things people need to think about. Don't just show up there and get surprised by it in the moment. You kind of need to negotiate this out on the phone before you even bother wasting your time to drive there. And so the refining side, they've obviously been overwhelmed. The dealers couldn't handle it, the local ones. So they were shipping a lot to get melted. And I think you have a situation in the United States where you have basically a duopoly. You have another monopoly system where basically there's only a few players in the market. You know, everything's been kind of hollowed out in terms of the refining capacity in the United States. You have about two generally large national refiners and then one kind of satellite that's, you know, the third largest. But they, you know, they basically came back from bankruptcy and they're back in the game, but they're not that large compared to the other two. And so they get overwhelmed with these 90%, you know, bringing all this back. So basically, essentially, if you're buying all this 90% back, you know, you have to question yourself is like, A, what am I doing day to day with my staff? Generally, they're probably dealing with 3.9 fine silver, you know, and maybe 4.9 because that's what, you know, electronics industry demands, which is very high pure silver. You really don't have time to sit around and do all the work that's required to refine 90%, which is a lot more labor intensive, and it requires a lot of chemical properties that are, I'm hearing rumors that are in shortage right now that are very difficult to get these processes to 3.9 fine completion. So that's another problem as well. So yeah, the 90% thing, I think it's, we've twisted though in the last 3 or 4 days where what you're going to probably end up seeing is that there's not going to be enough product to go around for people who are buying. And so what you're going to end up seeing is that 90% is going to probably go up in premiums as time goes along. And people who, you know, want some product or some allocation to physical metals are probably going to end up only having 90% as the option because a lot of the 3.95 bullion is going to get lost. And in terms of the amount of demand, it'll overwhelm the amount of 3.9 fine silver that's available. I mean, you have reports from every major government mint that they're all delayed, whether, you know, the United States mint, the Perth mint, the Canadian mint, they're all in like these allocations and they're very, very minimal in size. And it's basically, you just only have so much throughput in the 395 sovereign coin market. And as well, like the private round markets, I mean, the quotes of delivery delays, they're like 2 months out. I mean, that type of thing is already happening. And I've not even looked since Friday of what happened. But I mean, if anything, I mean, SD Bullion is an obvious example. We had gigantic four multiple sales in terms of on Friday versus the other days prior. That tells you that you have a huge bid on silver at these price ranges. So pressure is going to keep mounting and 90% will probably return back into a premium.
Mm-hmm. James, do you have any idea or information about refining capacity for, let's say, that lower grade silver in, let's say, China or India? And you know, we've seen much of this arbitrage from west to east. Do you think that is going to exist in that market as well?
It's possible. It's possible that you'll end up seeing a lot of 90% silver from the United States shores go offshore, right? If you were sitting there with piles of that stuff and you needed to get it off and off your balance sheet, like to have that trade with the large players in China generally who are fine and messier silver, you know, in quotes, that would be the play, is that you would actually arbitrage it through China and use their infrastructure, because our infrastructure can't handle it. I mean, obviously, it basically can barely handle what it has right now in terms of demand. And so, you know, the ability to move that 90% offshore to have it melted over there is something that's quite likely going to occur. You know, which parties are doing it, all the trust involved to do that, that requires a lot of work. That requires, you know, basically partnerships that you know are going to work, because to ship stuff to China and have everything work out, you know, at this time and under this type of political climate, you really have to know your counterparty. But you know, these refineries, they're large players. So, you know, they would not ruin or risk their reputation, I think. And so it's very quite likely that a lot of this 90% will get moved to China and melted down. You know, that is a high probability situation.
Mm-hmm. So because of the demand in obviously the more, let's say, popular or well-known precious metals, gold, silver, is that starting to trickle into platinum and palladium as well?
Totally. And that happened well before, like in the last month or two, just searching around, because I could see the price action in platinum, palladium was a no-brainer. Like where they were versus where they are now was obvious. And so you had a lot of people going around and buying up those white precious metals, you know. And palladium, I would say on the market, is probably the hardest one to find. Platinum is the next hardest, but they're very difficult to source. And if you can source them, the price premiums that people are trying to charge are sometimes outrageous. So you need to be kind of thorough in your work in terms of A, like, you know, what's the price that you're being able to get these products at? B, what are the types of products that you're getting? Are these things actually like trustworthy brands and hallmarks? Are these things legit? You know, I would suggest people stick with the most recognizable products, be them U.S. Mint products, or be it, you know, Pamp Suisse products, Valcombi Bar products, those types of things. But you have to be careful, because I'm sure there's a lot of phonies and fakes out there. So you have to be very careful about whom you source it from. If it's just some Joe Rando on eBay, you know, you could be getting some type of counterfeit thing. So you got to be very, very careful as to who you're trusting as to be your counterparty on that trade. But yes, you're dead ass right. I mean, the platinum and palladium have gone up and vanished. It's basically unobtainium in a lot of ways, especially in any size.
So backing out, James, a little bit here, are indications like, let's say, Tether buying more gold and holding more gold than most central banks? You know, Tether is a stablecoin, or, you know, for those that don't understand it, is almost like a cryptocurrency. They're backing their reserves with gold, more gold than many central banks. Is that another indication of, let's say, the direction of the change of the financial world at this point?
Yeah. So that talking point is a nice press release. No one's ever audited any of this stuff. And as far as Tether's concerned, I've never seen any audits on their treasury holdings as well. So I don't take anything they say at face value. I really don't. I think most of the times it's simply narrative, and whether or not it's true, you know, that's good luck. I don't know, because they've never done any true auditing. I think you know, Tether and other stable coins are basically something that the United States sees as a possibility of a way to kind of stick around longer in terms of the reserve currency balance, to be able to somehow proliferate stable coin US dollar networks throughout the world using stable coins. And so press releases like that are supposed to add credibility with like cartoon gold bar picks and, you know, just total clownery, like hiring all these different random people, you know, after the fact that, you know, in the industry that have some CVs in the precious metals industry, but then you don't hear from any of these people. None of them ever talk. You never see their face. You know, I mean, this amount of trust that they've built is not, it doesn't really exist. If you do any research, I mean, it's something that I don't spend all that much time, like, considering the fact that, like, I've already done enough research to realize that it's probably a scam. You know, Tether is not something to be trusted in. Virtually anything that they're associated with, run. That's the point. And so, yeah, I mean, that's what the United States government had. You know, you have Howard Lutnick, you know, foaming at the mouth, trying to, you know, make, you know, his generational, you know, makings in terms of money and power through the Tether network and other stablecoin networks. I'm sure he's trying to grift off of that. You know, so none of this is surprising. I mean, look at the people who are surrounding it. They're not trustworthy either. So I just run from that thing. That would be my main point. And yes, what it is signifying is the fact that they're using perception as a way to build trust in that network. But, you know, ultimately, anyone who's done the research would not trust a lick of what they say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting way to frame it. So, James, how do you think this all ends, right? Like, what do you think are the hallmarks of a multi-decade top in both gold and silver? And if you want to get super crazy, give us what you think they could go to as well, what those price levels.
So the fiat price levels are, you know, they're on the silver side, the rebalancing number is around $400 an ounce, $380 an ounce right now. And generally when they rebalance, they don't pull like a 2011 where they run away and hide again into some cyclical bear market that lasts forever. No, generally they get together and they run higher. So you could definitely have, you know, you could have a situation where silver even threatens four digits an ounce. And I'm not talking about, you know, in a world where, you know, bread is $30 or $50. I mean, that can occur in a world where prices are relatively stable, et cetera. So
just to interrupt, you're saying that the $400, $380 level is like a long-term sustainable price.
I think so. And not in the sense of like long-term sustainable. What ends up happening is these things connect. They last, they can run for 2-3 years together. But then eventually they pull apart. And so you had a situation, for instance, 2006 to 2008, where they hit and ran together, 1973, 74, 75, until the cyclical bear, they ran together. In 79, 78, and 80, they ran together. Not as long, because that was obviously a euphoric blow off top. And so I don't expect it'll be any different. You'll have a situation where silver goes into some type of ridiculous blow off top where it goes completely overvalued. And you know, that will come and go, and eventually it'll go to a number that'll be the high, and you know, as long as the currency doesn't go to high hell, that'll probably be the high for a long time. You know, people are always assuming that the US dollar is going to go up in some hyperinflationary smoke cloud, but the truth of the matter is it may not. You basically have the British pound after World War II was in kind of a certain situation where their debt to GDP was virtually as bad as where we are. Probably their unfunded liability pile wasn't as bad as ours, but ultimately they've inflated their way out and they're still alive. That fiat pound currency has not gone up in hyperinflation smoke. And so, you know, assume base case that the United States dollar doesn't go up in hyperinflation smoke. But in that scenario, gold and silver still have to run. They still have to account for the largesse and the amount of ridiculous spending that's going on. Mm-hmm. On the gold side, you know, there's cases you can make for obviously $10,000 an ounce gold. I think it's kind of a gimme now, just the way things have been going. But there's cases you can make if the bond market really starts going wrong and you know, $30,000, $40,000 gold is within the realm of possibilities. And psychologically, you can thank Bitcoin for the clown show that it ran, you know, going to six digits for Bitcoin. I mean, it basically prepares people to understand that a world of $30,000 to $40,000 gold doesn't mean the world falls apart. It just simply means that gold is at a ridiculous premium versus what you're used to in your life.
Excellent. Well, again, James, what do you think kind of...
Well, Tom, one other thing is that people need to kind of take the fiat currency out of it. They need to think in terms of ratios. So like gold and, you know, gold versus the Dow Jones Industrial Average over like the last 130, 140 years, and maybe not really think in terms of like, you know, where it's been the last 10, 20 years, maybe think in terms of where it's been for different time periods where the stock market went into a bubble and then went to a structural bear market, how far it can go on the gold side, being re-rated higher versus Dow. Same with the S&P 500, you know, gold and silver, both of them have massive data sets where you can go and do the research. You would start with the conservative target of the 2011 lows. That's pretty conservative. We're going back there. And then the question is, well, how long does it take then to go through there and go beyond that and to go into a place where we're back toward fair value and probably into overvaluation generally? So, you know, the relative ratios are really important to kind of take out the fiat currency noise. I think that's the main point. I just want to make sure that people understand that, you know, just putting $40,000 on a headline is silly. I mean, people don't understand the context or the nuance of what's being described. And so ratios is really the best way to kind of understand where true value.
Yeah, I was going to say, I completely agree with you. This idea of understanding where we are and where we're going from a relative value situation is, I think, a lot more helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. I mean, it could happen this year where the S&P 500, where it's nominally at, it's what, 7,000, where gold could meet it and it could go 1-to-1 this year. It's inevitably going to happen. Whether or not it happens this year or next, I'm not sure, but 1-to-1 on like 140 year timescale is kind of the average. It's like when you look at the chart, turn it sideways, what you realize is, oh, okay, well, it's actually kind of the middle of the entire data set. Oh, and the last some odd 40 or 50 years, we've been living in mostly a U.S. bubble economy. And so our entire perception of reality is totally skewed. Mm-hmm. Our lifetime has been in bubble landia in the U.S. stock market. You know, there's been a couple of times where it wasn't. Obviously, in the 70s, there wasn't. It was in the other side. And 1980, it went to an extreme overvaluation on the other side. And then 2011, we got toward fair value and probably a little bit near overvalue on the long data set, or right near, you know, basically fair value on the long data set. So, yeah, you really need to consider like the historic relative ratios and understand where you have been in your own lifetime to understand perhaps how skewed everybody's perception is. Because, you know, it's inevitable that you're going to hear a lot of people, you know, have takes and talking points. Their brains are skewed. They've been living in a fiat currency U.S. bond bubble and U.S. stock bubble forever. And they don't understand when those two things falls apart, how extreme you can get to the other side. Mm-hmm.
Excellent, James. Well, as we wrap up here, is there anything you'd like to leave our listeners to think about before we do?
Yeah, the 1980 price of housing, the median price of houses in the United States is now matched roughly the price of a house in gold today. But basically about 80 ounces of gold would afford you a U.S. median price home, which is about $415,000. For that to occur already, we're literally at the same place we were during Q1 1980, now in Q1 2026. And then you look at the stock market and how still out of whack that is. And you have a bond market and you have an unfunded liability problem and a debt problem. That basically tells you that we have much further to go in terms of gold's purchasing power versus U.S. homes. And the same with silver. Silver is still not back toward its 1980 low, but it will go there just by the fact that in terms of the out of whackness that silver and gold have been in the other asset classes. So you have two of three homes owned by boomers in the United States, and they are going to be dying precipitously or, you know, drawing down their houses, especially in early 2030s. Who's going to buy all those houses? And at what price and under what terms? These are the questions. And you can damn well bet it's going to be cheaper in gold and silver by that time than it is today. And the fact that we are already at the 1980 Mendoza line on the gold side tells you this is going to be the all-timer in terms of extremity of how crazy this will get. So it's all positive news. It's good. Just accept the volatility. That's generally how it works in a bull market. So just make sure that you pair your trade so you can handle it and that you're not, you know, over-levered and your percentage of your bullion allocation or your precious metals allocation isn't moving wildly so you can't sleep at night. You need to have it relative toward what gives you peace of mind. Mm-hmm.
Well said, James. It's an excellent point to remember in these volatile times. Of course, you do an excellent kind of weekly wrap-up YouTube video. That's over on your is it the SD Bullion YouTube channel?
Yeah, right. The official SD Bullion channel. If you just look up SD Bullion YouTube, you'll find it. Every close of trading on Friday, generally around 9, 10 p.m. Eastern, I publish probably a 10 to 20 minute video trying to aggregate and consolidate kind of the most important data and information on the week, and to kind of give people a fast, dense understanding of what occurred that week, whether, you know, most people are too busy working to try and keep up with all the nonsense. I try and skew out the nonsense and actually keep the stuff that I see it matters and filter it through a lens of someone who's been in this market for almost 20 years. So that's all free. It's at SD Bullion YouTube channel. And people can also follow me at James Henry And on Twitter, X.
And of course, SDBullion.com.
Of course, SDBullion.com. Remember, if you're going to buy bullion, we are inundated. So have patience. If you purchase bullion, it's probably going to be a few weeks before the package gets packed, picked back and slipped, because there is a long line right now. So yeah, SDBullion.com.
Excellent. James, thanks so much for your time today. I always appreciate it, man.
Tom, great to see you.